Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 197, featuring Hal Hickel of Industrial Light and Magic. Hal Hickel is a legend in the visual effects world. He is a very accomplished animation director at ILM, and he has done a number of things over the years. Actually, he and I went through a little bit of his history, and he started in stop motion, in literally claymation stop motion. He did back in the day, did the claymation versions of the California Raisins. Some of you older guys may remember that. But it's pretty cool. And then he transitioned over to CG when he went on to Pixar and worked on the Toy Story. Then now is obviously, as I said, a very accomplished animation director at ILM and has been there for many, many years and has done some incredible work there. And I really kind of appreciated it. I've actually known Hal for a while through a forum that we were both part of called 3D Pro. It's the first time I met him in person, and I met him at THU, the conference that I love dearly, that is this year held in Malta. So we were meeting up in Malta. We chatted for a while and had a great, great conversation. While we were hanging out that time, we actually got to talk about digital humans for a while. And this is actually pretty important because Hal's actually has an important role to play in digital humans in terms of the history of visual effects, because he was the animation director on Rogue One. So he did Grand Moff Tarkin. As some of you know, that's been very controversial, and there's been some very interesting discussion about that work. I actually find it fascinating, and especially the question of ethics, because this is an actor who has passed on and then recreated his character in there. Hal brought up a fantastic argument about why it's completely ethical to bring back that character. And I really think that for those of you who are listening to this and thinking about digital humans and thinking about the role they play, and there's always going to be that question of ethics, and Hal brings up a fantastic argument that I really, really appreciated going through with him. So thank you so much for doing that, Hal. Really incredible guy and really, really smart guy. And I'm a very, very important person in the world of animation. So it was a really great podcast. Just a couple of announcements. Well, more than a couple, unfortunately. I want to make sure that you guys know about in terms of Chaos Group. So the first thing is this week, or the week just before this podcast came out, we announced V-Ray for Cinema 4D is officially coming to the Chaos Group family. As some of you may know, V-Ray for Cinema 4D was licensed to a third party, which is Stefan Laub. And so Stefan has now passed on the reins to us. That means that V-Ray will now actually be maintained and supported by Chaos Group itself. So for those of you who have a V-Ray for Cinema 4D license, you can transfer your license over to Chaos Group and go to our new licensing server and licensing system. This gives you full access to all of the stuff that we're going to be doing in the future with it, as well as support, et cetera. Obviously, there's a whole question about pricing and transferring and all of that stuff. So go to chaosgroup.com and go check out all the information about V-Ray for Cinema 4D there for all up-to-date information. But I know you Cinema 4D guys will be very excited about that. The next bit of news, and now this is a little bit older, but V-Ray Next for Maya is officially out as a product. So those of you who have been waiting for V-Ray Next for Maya, it is now out. It is actually really, really cool. I really appreciate it every time I start using it and I discover new things that I kind of know about, and I actually try them and they're fantastic. My latest favorite thing right now that I love to play with is what's called the debug shader, and it's a mode in IPR that allows you to just try all kinds of stuff and it just updates on the fly. It's kind of cool and you got to go check it out. Highly recommend you guys go to, if you guys have V-Ray Next for Maya, it is absolutely awesome, including the ability to just select a couple of lights and then it'll just only IPR your scene with those lights. So you can do light selects really quickly and on the fly. Really useful to have. It's pretty cool. But also there's a ton of other features. That's just my latest one I like to play with. V-Ray Cloud. V-Ray Cloud is still in beta and you guys can still use it and try it out for free to get free cloud rendering. I don't know how much longer it's going to be. So if you guys are even thinking about trying it, I would recommend you try it pretty soon, because it is going to become a real product very, very soon. And for any other announcements, I'm going to say, if you guys want to check out events, there's a ton of events that we're going through. We're going to be in Bangalore and all over the place. So go to chaosgroup.com/events to find out all the different events that we're going to be at as well. That's about it I have for Chaos Group. For the podcast itself, as I always say, I would love to hear back from you. Any suggestions, comments, whatever, please come check us out. You can always just email us, which is labs@chaosgroup.com. You can always go on Facebook and go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. That is our Facebook page. And so you can like us there, comment there, whatever. You can always tweet at us. That's CG_labs. Oh boy, there's a ton of places you can go. Of course, my favorite thing that I would love to hear in terms of your feedback is go to iTunes and give us a nice rating, hopefully 5 if you think we deserve it, and leave us a comment and a review there. That would also be very useful for us. All right, guys, that's about all I got. With that being said, please, please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Hal Hickel from Industrial Light and Magic. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I've actually communicated with you in the past on 3D Pro.
Oh yeah, right.
So you and I have been on 3D Pro for a while. I've been on there for 15 years or so.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've probably much longer than that.
Yeah, man, it goes all the way. I feel like it, I can't remember a time when I wasn't right on it. Yeah, so.
But what, I mean, that's, so you've been in the industry for quite a while. When would you say we just...
Well, technically, I mean, my first job in the industry was in 1984, so I've been in for a long time.
1984.
Yeah, I was doing motion graphics stuff, working on an Oxbury at a little motion graphics house in Portland in 84, okay, right after I left CalArts. And I was there for about 4 years, and then I went over to Vinton's. I had a buddy who worked there, Vince Backyberg, and he's like, you should come over here. You know, you used to do stop motion when you were... kid, I know you love that. You should come over and do that, because they were blowing up because of the California raisins and they were hiring.
Right.
So I got hired at Vinton's and I was there for 6.5 years. And that kind of refocused me back onto character animation.
So what was your fascination with character animation?
Well, it's interesting because, so prior to that, and when I was at CalArts, what I was really interested in then was what now would be called effects animation.
Okay.
Like the animation that Adam Beckett did for the first Star Wars, when the Jawas shoot R2 and all those little blue electrical arcs crawl all over.
Uh-huh.
That really, I thought that was amazing and I wanted to do that. But I was also really interested in stuff like slit scan, like the Stargate sequence in 2001.
Right.
So I was really interested in that. So that's why I went to work for this motion graphics place. Now, this was a tiny little shop in Portland and we were doing basically local advertising. But it gave me access to an Oxbury so I could learn how to do streak photography and slit scan stuff on it.
Uh-huh.
But again, my friend Vince said, hey, you know, because I did stop motion as a kid with a Super 8 camera, and he's like, hey, you did stop motion, you'd be great. And we're doing national ads, and this whole California raisins thing is blowing up. You should come over here, you'll have a lot more fun. So I did. He was right. And so I was there for 6.5 years. And so there I was a stop motion animator. We were doing clay animation, but stop motion.
Yeah.
And I had some other roles as well. I got really interested in motion control camera stuff, so I kind of took that on as my little department to run the motion control camera.
What were you systems. Doing animation on?
What kind of projects?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, projects.
Well, we were doing, you know, commercials for the California Raisins, and then ABC commissioned, I think we did three,
so you did like
three specials, half-hour specials, yeah.
The Ray Charles one?
Yeah. Okay. So the Ray Charles one happened right before I joined.
Okay.
But like that series of commercials.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
So. And then we did these half-hour specials for ABC, that some of which, with two of them were with the California Raisins, and then we did a couple more, maybe there were four that were other characters. We did an Easter special and a Halloween special. So it was a lot of that and a lot of commercials for other things. We just did a lot of commercial work. But my my goal was to end up at ILM. I was hooked on visual effects. That's what I wanted to do.
Right.
But by the time I was, you know, well into my time at Vinton's, my interest had shifted from, you know, slit scan and miniatures and all that to character work. So I envisioned myself one day, you know, working with Phil Tippett on, you know, some stop motion creature at ILM. That was my dream.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Jurassic Park came out, and I saw my whole future go up in flames because I was like, well, I don't know anything about computer graphics. And
really? So,
yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I think that a lot of people adapted, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's
just, everyone thought it was like the end of stop motion, but
yeah.
It was just an evolution because stop motion turned into something else.
Yeah. Right? No, exactly. But so, again, backing up a little bit, you know, I had this interest in motion graphics,
right.
Which back in the early 80s was all being done with backlit black and white artwork with gels and multiple exposures on these down, you know, on Oxberries, these camera systems.
Right.
But all through the 80s, what happened was that all got superseded by computer graphics.
Right.
Really took over all the flying logos and all the motion graphics stuff. Mm-hmm. So I watched that happen, but I had kind of sidestepped into clay animation and character work by that time.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'm doing that, again, heading toward this goal of, you know, I'm going to do stop motion like Ray Harryhausen, you know, as a visual effects thing. Then Jurassic Park comes out, and now computer graphics have sort of taken that over as well. So I was blown away by the movie, but
right.
In terms of my career, I was really disheartened because I just thought, okay, well, I guess I'm going to be pushing mud puppets. That's what we call them. Mud puppets for...
Why did you call them mud puppets?
Well, they were clay,
right.
Which was like basically mud.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, I'll be pushing mud puppets, doing commercials for the rest of my life. Because I thought basically everybody who was doing computer graphics at the time was wearing like a white lab coat and had a computer science degree. And what I didn't realize is that, yes, there were some people, maybe not in white lab coats, but who had computer science degrees and other types of, you know, really highly technical backgrounds. But there was also a need for animators, people who just understood character animation.
Yeah.
And even then, even at that early stage, software like ILM, for instance, was using Softimage at that time,
mm-hmm.
You know, was artist friendly. Like, it wasn't that hard to learn, but I didn't understand all that. To me, it was just like this black. I was up in Portland, you know, Vinton's
right.
wasn't really connected to the whole visual effects industry down south. So I just thought, well, I don't know, you know, I didn't feel like I could go back to school and get a computer science degree
right.
that I really wanted to. Anyways, then I just got a lucky break because Pixar was they were behind on Toy Story and they had kind of a bottleneck of the work and they were just trying to find more animators. And Mike Belzer, who was working there then, who had a background in stop motion,
mm-hmm.
kind of put out some feelers and contacted other stop motion people he knew far and wide, and one of them was Teresa Drilling, who's a terrific stop motion director.
Mm-hmm.
And she, at that time, she and I were working together at Vinton's, and she knew that I really wanted to figure out how to make that jump, like how to get on to the next level and learn how to do that. So she said, "Hey, you know, they're looking for animators. Apparently, they don't care if you even know how to switch on a computer. They'll show you how their software apparently is artist friendly." So I sent a reel down with my stop motion work from Vinton's, and I got hired. And so that was just a massively lucky break for me. And in fact, so this thing that I thought, this evil thing, computer graphics, that had been sort of chasing my career and eating it
mm-hmm.
up behind me as I went along, when I got to Pixar, I found that I actually enjoyed animating characters that way in the computer. You know, I still love stop motion. I love watching it. I love the little puppets. I love cameras and all that stuff. But as a way to animate a character, for me personally, it just, the CG method sort of fit with my brain better, being able to kind of layer stuff and you know, treat the different parts of it almost separately rather than having to do, you know, 100% of everything, every frame.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, I admire the hell out of the great, you know, stop motion animators who are still doing the craft. My buddy Chuck Duke. He kind of floats between worlds. He's a really, really talented guy. But
well, they're still doing a lot of stop motion in Portland, right? Like, still
a ton of it. And he was actually just over in the UK working on that last Wes Anderson film, Isle of Dogs. So
yeah.
there's, and that's the beautiful thing is, you know, as you said, that CG didn't end stop motion. It put an end to it as a means for doing realistic creatures in live action films. It
right.
stopped being the right tool for that job. But for everything else, for, you know, Wallace and Gromit and all the beautiful films that Laika does, and mm-hmm. You know, and then the two Wes Anderson films and all the brilliant you know, personal films and short films people do with stop motion, it's still, you know, very much alive and well, and I couldn't be happier about that. But
yeah. And then, yeah. So it's interesting that, you know, you went from the fear of, like, I'm never going to work in computer graphics, to suddenly you're working on the first movie ever done fully CG.
I know. It was crazy. It was yeah. really crazy. And the thing was, you know, I knew a lot of stop motion animators who just had zero interest in doing CG. Actually, Teresa, who you know, tipped me off and said, you should send your reel down. She didn't. She didn't have any interest, and she still doesn't.
Right.
And with me, it wasn't that I didn't have interest. In fact, once Jurassic Park came out and I kind of got over this sort of crushing blow of feeling like my career future had evaporated, you know, I absorbed every article, every making of piece, everything about it.
Right.
And I just was trying to figure out, well, how can I, what do I need to do? Like, how do I get there?
Right.
So I wanted to do it. And maybe that was also part of why my transition was successful.
Okay.
Because I knew people... I knew other stop motion animators, some that were in the Bay Area at the time, who had, you know, maybe worked on Nightmare Before Christmas or that kind of thing, who came to Pixar at that exact same time that I did, but almost kind of grudgingly, because mm-hmm. like, well, it's a job, it's available, and this seems to be the future, so I'll give it a try. And while their work ultimately was great, they just didn't enjoy it, and so. Many of them left after, you know, one or two films in CG and went back to stop motion. But for me, it was, I got in there and was like, wow, this is great. I love this. And so
awesome.
I just kept moving forward with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that people may transition. You know, obviously I spoke to Aaron Sims and
yep.
you know, he came from the practical Stan Winston school, stuff
yep.
like that. Right. Not Stan Winston, but, he was going through the same thing, and everyone's like, well, that's the end of, you know, makeup and all
right.
the other stuff.
Yeah.
And suddenly he's like, maybe there's a way I can do this on the computer. Maybe I could just learn the computer. Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot to be said about that.
Yeah.
To just go with the times. And there's going to be another phase that happens here. Right.
Yeah.
I have a feeling the phase of like deep learning and AI and all that stuff is going to start to make people worried that they're going to lose their skill set a little bit or not.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
No, absolutely. I think that is the next, because I visited ILM for the first time during the summer before Jurassic came out. So mm-hmm. like 92, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a guest, I just,
right.
Dennis Mirren showed me around and at that time, they still had their big Automatte camera, which was their big camera system for shooting matte paintings.
Mm-hmm.
They still had a bunch of down shooters and a bunch of other equipment from sort of the pre-digital age.
Right.
And all their optical printers. And when I came back to work, to start work as an employee at ILM 4 years later in 96, all uh-huh. that stuff was gone. They had a couple of printers still around that they needed for certain kind of basic stuff that the printers were still good, handy for.
Yeah.
Some of the other printers were gone. All the down shooters were gone. The Automatte camera was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel lucky I got a chance to just lay eyes on that stuff before
yeah.
it evaporated. But I
felt the same way at DD when all the film scanners are gone.
Yeah. And it occurred to me later, I thought that was just 4 years. That must have been an incredibly wrenching transition. And there were plenty of people there who stuck with it and made the transition,
yep.
you know, people who were in optical and then found, you know, learned to do things on the digital side or modelers or texture artists. But it must have been super wrenching. And I think you're right. I think AI is probably the next thing. Well, the current wrenching thing, depending on where you live in the world, has mm-hmm. been more on the financial side of things, right?
Sure.
Like the difficulties in California versus, you know, if you're in the UK
tax
or something.
Yeah,
exactly. But I think... in terms of technology and revolutionizing things and people worrying about their jobs disappearing and whatnot. Yeah, I think AI is absolutely the place to look for that. I mean, it's exciting. There's going to be cool things. But
I think it's going to be different. I think people are going to have to embrace it. And when they embrace it, they're going to be better for it.
Oh, sure. Well, and it's the same I think that that's exactly the same thing that happened with CG.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Absolutely.
And then some folks, I think, kind of took that trend, and it'll happen this time too, will take that transition as their time to sort of retire or go start, you know, open that bagel shop in, you know, Utah
maybe,
or something.
Maybe. I always want to go fly fishing. So.
Yeah, exactly.
But, okay, so when you said you started in 96?
Yeah.
96 at ILM. So what did you go in as a character person there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I worked on Toy Story at Pixar for about the last 6 months of production, but I think we had like more than half the film left to animate in that amount of time. But anyway, so we did that, and then there was going to be a gap between that and the next film, Bug's Life.
Right.
And I loved Pixar. I mean, it was such an awesome time to be there. It was still really small. I mean, I think it's still an awesome place to be, but just saying, it was just really small. It was kind of an extraordinary time in the company's history. But I still really had this, you know, yearning to do the Ray Harryhausen thing more than the feature animation thing. So
right.
I now had a reel with CG animation on it. So I sent that over and crossed the way. And, you know, they were getting ready to do a sequel to Jurassic Park, and George had announced he was going to do more Star Wars movies, and I just thought, well, you know, now's the time. I got to try.
Right.
So I sent over the tape, and yeah, I was just hired as an animator, and my first project was Lost World.
Oh, yeah.
Animated dinosaurs for a while, and then the second project was Phantom Menace. And so yeah, it's great.
So what were some of your experiences in those early days in live action stuff? Was it different? It must have been different.
It was different, although I had grown up wanting to do that.
Sure.
So I'd kind of wrapped my, even with the new technology, I'd kind of wrapped my head around what the paradigm was. You know, like, obviously, working on Toy Story, it's 100% digital. It's mm-hmm. like a feature animation paradigm. You know, there's board-o-matics, then there's a layout, and layout gets handed to the animators, blah, blah, blah. But I understood, you know, like, it wasn't surprising to me at ILM that a layout was something based on a piece of live footage, mm-hmm. and that's what you would work from,
mm-hmm.
and put your character in there. Because to me, it was just super analogous to what Ray Harryhausen had done.
Right.
You know, our background plate in our layout in our scene was like his rear projection screen with his puppet in front of it.
And yeah.
So it all, none of that was sort of hard to adjust to, mm-hmm. even though there's obviously there's sort of two different kinds of things. And I enjoyed the emphasis on realism again, because as a kid, it just, the whole idea of making a creature and putting it in a live action movie and trying to convince people that it was really there in the scene,
mm-hmm.
that just tickles me. It always has, and it's
right.
And that's why I, you know, because believe me, leaving Pixar is not an easy thing to do, especially like right on the heels of Toy Story, which was like so, you know,
revolutionary,
successful.
Yeah.
But I just really wanted to do that. So
you wanted to make people believe something was real.
Yeah, I liked the idea of working, you know, being part of a team making a live action movie. I love animation. I love animated features. I see everything that comes out as much as I can. But, you know, going all the way back to my childhood, the thing that really sparked me originally actually was the original King Kong. Now, I saw it on TV, not in the theater.
Right.
I'm not that old. But but then, you know, the original King Kong and then all of Ray's films. And that was really the thing. I mean, I liked animated features, and Fantasia was a huge mm-hmm. had a huge impact on me, but not as much as
King Kong,
Ray's stuff, and King Kong. And then, you know, Star Wars came out and kind of broadened my whole interest in visual effects to a lot of other areas. But still, live action movies was where my interest was at.
So. I think definitely Star Wars had stop motion in it that was different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like a next step
in
a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. And Phil was experimenting with Go Motion
on
Empire with the Tauntaun, and that was a really cool thing. And So that's always what I wanted to do. And so once I got there, I was just, you know, like I was like in heaven.
Yeah. So on those in those early years that you had at ILM, because I don't want to. You've been there for a long. How long have you been on? I guess
22 years.
22 years.
Yeah.
So let's call those early years.
Yeah.
Which were the projects that really sort of like sparked you into doing something that like led you to some of the stuff you're doing now?
Well, Lost World and Phantom Menace were both really formative because, largely because of the animation supervisors I had on both of those shows. Randy Dutra was the anim soup on Lost World, and he was great. Nobody understands animal locomotion like Randy does.
Right.
So he was awesome. And then Rob Coleman, the animation director on all three of the prequels, is just an awesome guy. Like, he's a tremendously talented animation director, but he's also a really great soup in terms of how he, a supervisor, in terms of how he works with the animators, you know, runs the crew, and how he deals with the director. And I learned a huge amount from Rob mm-hmm. about how to be a soup. Because that's, once I got there and I kind of saw how things worked and, you know, what the hierarchy was, my goal was to become an animation supervisor at ILM. And so Rob really was a great mentor in that regard. So those films were super formative, basically mainly for that, for those reasons.
And then, because suddenly you saw your next step, right?
And I had great role models.
Right.
Like, I saw the next step and I had really good role models. And then AI came along, and that was my first film as a supervisor. That was my first souping gig.
Really? Yeah.
And so that was huge for me. And I had, you know, Dennis Muren was the effects supervisor, and he and Scott Farrar actually both. And so, you know, our most senior visual effects supervisors were doing the show. And it was my first opportunity, since I was now the anim soup, to spend time on set. Mm-hmm. And getting to watch Dennis and Scott operate on set was, again, massively instructive. Like, I could just stand there and listen the whole time. Like, I didn't really have to say anything. You know, there were times when I was expected to contribute or participate, and I did. But most of the time, I would either be listening to Scott and Dennis or to Steven Spielberg. I'd just try to stay out of the way, but near enough by that I could listen to how he spoke to his cinematographer or his actors or, you know, any of his other creative collaborators. Mm-hmm. And that helped me later on when we were doing the shots in post-production and presenting them to him. It gave me a preview of, like, what kind of vocabulary I could expect, what sorts of things he's looking for, what his sense of humor is like,
right,
all those things. So so that was a huge learning process for me.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
I really like obviously the animation was, you know, incredible. But it was a very, very influential in terms of very different types of things, right? You had somewhat human things, and so that was maybe probably one of your first. Was that one of your first ventures into humanish type things?
Not a whole lot, because we didn't have to do. Well, a little bit. Like, we had some things where you see robots who were missing parts of themselves, or the face sort of opens up as a mechanism, and that.
Right.
But we didn't have to do, like, for instance, David, the robot boy. Mm-hmm. It was always Haley. We never had to do a CG version of him. I mean, our main goals or tasks on that film, animation wise, was Teddy.
Yeah.
Because he was Stan Winston creation as much as possible. But anytime he had to run around and do certain things, we were animating him. And then the big sort of very tall, thin, sentient future robot race that we see at the end of the film.
Right.
We had to do those guys, and those were the main chores. And there was a lot of other things. There were shots where we had to do that helicopter thing, flying machine, and then fish and other, you know, odd different things. But those were the main chores. And actually, that was good for me, because while it was a big high profile film, it wasn't like there was, you know, 1,000 animation shots. And so I just, you know, as my first project, I didn't get dumped into this massively complex thing. It was kind of focused on, you know, Teddy and the beings at the end of the film, and a few other odds and ends. And so it was a good start for me.
It was a good start.
Yeah.
And so you continued on there as an animation supervisor for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's been my role since then. I mean, my title on Rango is animation director, but it's kind of the same thing.
Right.
It's just that credit was possible on that film and sort of appropriate given my role, but generally my credit is animation.
Was it strange going back to full feature animation again?
Actually, I feel super lucky, because you know, if that film or any animated feature had come along maybe, say, 5 years earlier right. for me, I would have felt like, I came here to do live action. But by the time Rango came along, we'd already made three films with Gore, and we love working with Gore, and it felt like I had a great relationship with him. So for that reason, obviously, it was like a no-brainer. It was like, absolutely, we're going to make this film. This is going to be great.
Right.
But also, just for me personally, it was at a good time. I was like, yeah, I'm ready to shake it up and do something different.
Right.
And, you know, my only experience with animated features up to that point was just as an animator on Toy Story, which doesn't really prepare you for a broader role. You're just focused on your shots.
You were only on, you weren't there that long.
I wasn't on for that long, yeah. So, and actually, almost everybody at ILM who worked on it had either very limited experience with animated features or none.
Right.
There were a few key people who had worked, say, at Disney or some other places that, mm-hmm. that kind of helped. But most of us were neophytes, and including Gore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd never made an animated film. So that was good and bad, but I'd say mostly good.
Right.
You know, in that we didn't know what we didn't know, and we could just do things the way we thought they should be done. And so it was great. We loved it. And in fact, still to this day, if you talk to artists from really any discipline at ILM who worked on it, they'll tell you it's one of their favorite things they've ever done there, and they can't wait to do another one.
Yeah. So. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
I want to fast forward a little bit to some of the stuff that we talked about when we were on the boat the other day, because I thought it was really fascinating, and I think that's going to be a long discussion.
Yeah.
So what we discussed is, you know, obviously we talked about digital humans, and it's a big interest of mine, and a lot of my listeners know that because of the WikiHuman project stuff that I've been turning to.
Right. Yep.
So what I'm really interested in finding out is first of all, let's go through the process of what you've discussed as digital humans, and what are some of the challenges you see right there? Because I know, obviously, you've done a lot of digital humans, and obviously the stuff that you did on Star Wars is a big proponent of that.
Right.
So let's discuss that a little bit and see where
where
that goes.
I mean, it kind of depends on what you're doing. Like, for instance, on Star Wars, the problem we had, and there's no solution to this problem, actually, is, for instance, with Tarkin, you're recreating a character that's based, that was played by an actor who's no longer with us.
Yeah.
And so anyone who is familiar with that actor seeing the film can't help but know that it's artificial, no matter how good it is. It's just in their head that you've done some kind of trick to bring him back to life. And that I think is kind of insurmountable. Like, there's no fix for that. And so that's not always the reason people are doing CG. Like, for instance, at that time, Carrie Fisher was still with us, and we did her in the film. And so in that case, it was a little bit different. Like, you might have had some audience members who thought, oh, is that some old footage that they modified? In fact, that was Carrie's reaction when she saw it. She asked Kathy, she said, is that outtakes from the original Star Wars, and you just change the lip sync or something? And Kathy's like, no, that's all CG. And Carrie was like, what? But with Tarkin, you know, you're always going to have this segment of the viewers who are familiar enough with, you know, who that person is and everything, that then they just, there's no overcoming that. They know it's artificial. Now, fortunately, there are a lot of casual Star Wars fans who only kind of know who Tarkin is and don't really know who Peter Cushing is.
Right.
And that, and it, for most of them, I think it just sailed right past them. It was like it was just a dude on film, and that's good. And so, to that extent, I think we succeeded. But anyway, so that's one case thing. But there are a lot of angles to this. I'm trying to figure out the best way to attack this
we can go back and forth. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But there was a discussion about the ethics of this, right? Because there's something that we challenged with, you know, when I was at DD and we brought Tupac back to life, right?
Right. Yep.
It was a thing of like, well, do you really have the right to do that?
Yeah.
And who says that you can do that? And they can't believe they made a version of him and he's not here to be okay with that.
To approve it, sure.
Right.
Yeah. No, I've thought a lot about that. And I've come to some conclusions about it, I think. I still wrestle with it a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, the really absolute position is, hey, if the person's not alive to say yes to the role, then it's not okay. So that's one very sort of hardline absolute thing.
Right.
I feel like there is a more nuanced approach. For me personally, I think resurrecting deceased actors to sell vacuum cleaners and things, I'm not on board with it. Like sure. That's something that, to me, I'm like, okay, nope, I don't think that's ethical. I don't think we should do that.
Right.
But then let's take Tarkin as an example. Mm-hmm. In that case, Lucasfilm reached out to the estate. Now, again, the purist might say, oh, that's fine, but you can't talk to the actor themselves to ask them if they would have taken this role. Okay, but there are plenty of interviews with Peter Cushing from back in the day that show that he was super happy to be part of Star Wars. And in fact, if his character hadn't died in the first film, he would have been happy to, you know, appear in more of the films.
Okay. Right.
So that taken on board with the fact that we didn't ask his character to do anything that Tarkin didn't do in the first film. In other words, he's standing around on the Death Star talking about blowing up planets, right?
Right.
So I think those things all made me at least feel very comfortable with what we were doing.
Yeah.
It was respectful. It was in line with what he'd done before. We knew that he enjoyed doing what he did before.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel, and his estate approved of it. So it felt like, okay, this seems okay and appropriate. Now, again, if you're taking the most pure position on this and saying, sorry, you still couldn't ask him, so it's not okay. But I think there's a more nuanced way to look at it. So that was my rationale, I guess, for saying that, you know, yes, this is okay. The other thing is that we're not creating Peter Cushing. In other words, we're not creating Peter Cushing as he looked in normal life in his street clothes and putting words in his mouth.
Right.
Like you would if this was a biopic about Peter Cushing.
Right.
That, I think, is much trickier ground. Mm-hmm. However,
it's been done.
Well, and yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting because when you bring back Peter Cushing playing Tarkin, these conversations come up. I've had a bunch of people ask me about, you know, sort of the ethics
sure.
of doing that. On the other hand, when Gary Oldman plays Winston Churchill in makeup, Anthony mm-hmm. Hopkins plays Alfred Hitchcock in makeup, those questions don't come up. Nobody cares. Nobody ever raises that. Now, they will raise issues if they feel like the films were sort of historically inaccurate, but the actual issue of whether it's ethical for someone to don the makeup and be the person, and
right.
and this isn't even a case of playing a character that person played. You're actually playing that person and fictionalizing their real life. You would think
right.
that would be much more controversial. Nobody bats an eyelid.
Right.
But do it with CG, and for some reason,
I know,
it becomes this whole other thing. It really trips people out. And the fact is, transforming Gary Oldman via makeup into Winston Churchill is not one iota different than transforming Guy Henry into Peter Cushing as Tarkin via CG makeup, if
right.
you will.
Yeah.
There's no difference at all. But again, it's interesting to me that it sort of tweaks people.
Because let's say you didn't use CG, but you used really good makeup to make him look like Peter Cushing,
yeah.
no one would question it.
They'd be perfectly fine
with it.
Yeah.
And that's not... That's wrong.
it's wrong that there's a difference there. They should, yeah.
yeah.
But yeah, it's fascinating to me. And then there's a bunch of other aspects of this that I think a lot about. For instance, I've had this kind of old fashioned notion in my head for a long time that, and I started thinking about this when Beowulf came out. And in Beowulf, you know, they made that choice to have some of the characters actually look like the actors, the motion cast, you know. So
yep.
Anthony Hopkins looked like Anthony Hopkins. Ray Winstone looked like a young Ray Winstone, but it was Ray Winstone and, you know, Angelina Jolie. Hopkins was the one that was most like his real self.
Okay.
And I remember looking at that and thinking, you know, even if you got to the point where you could do that completely flawlessly, just you could reproduce an actor 100% flawlessly, with no giveaways, no hitches for the, you know, convincing for an entire length of a film,
mm-hmm.
I thought to myself, why would you do it? Because I like actors. I like real people. I like
sure.
knowing they have a life outside of the movie.
Yeah.
I'm not a gossip hound, but I just, you know, I enjoy knowing that they're real people who've made these quirky choices in the moment while they were acting and all that stuff.
And you can't wait to see that person's interpretation of that character.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so down the road when we'll have the ability to create, and not just ersatz versions of existing actors, but just, you know, completely fictional new people, but they're synthetic. Mm-hmm. They're not real. They never really lived. To me, I don't know how interesting that is. It's interesting from a technological point of view. And it's obviously something that has to be pursued for things like games and things where, you know, you're creating agents that have to respond to gameplay and that, you know, it has to be a CG person. And I understand the pursuit of making really realistic humans for that goal. But mm-hmm. for just, you know, narrative film, I'm like, well, I think if someone did, like, for instance, if someone did the, you know, Final Fantasy today, but with the technology, let's say they got to the point where it was completely flawless, it just looked like totally real people all the way through, I'd be like, well, okay, but I like looking at actors. I look real people. It's not that interesting to me. Okay, so that's, but I consider that to be kind of an old-fashioned notion, or I've started to understand that. I think it's an sure. old-fashioned notion. And one of the things that got me there is, for instance, there are some Instagram influencers.
Yeah,
these
days. I know. We've talked about it.
Yeah, and they have millions of followers, mm-hmm. like this, you know, Little Michaela. I think mm-hmm. we were talking about Little Michaela, and people are genuinely interested in her as much as any other celebrity. Let's say, not necessarily as a real person, but then of course you start thinking, well, are celebrities to most of us who don't ever meet them, are they real people?
Sure.
And even especially if you think back to like the golden age of Hollywood, when the studios tightly controlled their actors' bios, and they didn't, like now we know everything about them because they're all over Instagram and they're tweeting all the time. Right. And I think, but in the back in the, you know, the studio age, they created practically fictional backstories for these people. Right. You know, like it was really fake. But anyway, just to say that people, some of her followers at least, you know, follow her as avidly and care about what's going on with her, and she's completely synthetic. So I think, well, okay, maybe I'm just old-fashioned. There may be a future where people adore digital actors that never lived, never existed. They're completely synthetic,
right?
And can enjoy them just as much as I personally enjoy watching Jack Nicholson or Gene Hackman or Meryl Streep.
Right.
Maybe someday there will be. I mean, I feel like a Luddite saying this, but it makes me a little sad because, you know, I like actors. I like watching them. I like watching people. But it's an interesting future to think that, you know, people who are young now may, in the future, it may not matter to them whether it's an actor they're looking at or a CG creation. And that's interesting, you know. I don't.
Is it really any different than, for example, like Max Headroom was not a real thing, but he would appear constantly in like TV specials or commercials or...
I mean, it was Matt Frewer, who is interesting
to
look at.
Sure,
but conceptually it was portraying a future like that, where there was a personality right. on TV that everyone liked it, or I don't know, whether they liked him or not, but he wasn't a real thing. And yeah, I mean, again, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. I think, like I say, that's why I think some of my feelings about it are kind of old fashioned, you know,
well,
in a way.
And I'm not necessarily much younger than you, yeah. but I think that you're right, that there's a weirdness that's going on there, and that yeah. I just don't understand. I don't understand it much either.
Yeah.
I don't understand. First of all, I don't even understand influencers on Instagram.
Well, yeah, that whole thing is very foreign to
me
too.
So,
yeah.
So that's just one step beyond that,
yeah.
That foreign aspect.
Yeah.
But the fact that there is a CG person that is perceived, because honestly, there's, while I assume that most people would realize she's fake because she doesn't.
She doesn't look that real.
She doesn't look that real.
No. Totally.
But some people think she's real.
Some people do think she's real. It's true.
And they were very upset when they found out she was CG.
Yeah. Well, and the people who created her created a villain for her.
Yeah.
Who hacked her account.
I know. Who's also not real.
Who's also not real. Exactly. It was a storyline created by the creators. But and people got all wound up about it.
Yeah.
That Little Michaela had her account hacked. And the person that hacked it was meant to be this sort of right-wing Trump supporter, and so that there was a whole political angle. So, you know, it's very peculiar. And but, so the thing is, here's the other thing. The state we're at now, you still need actors to perform the, you know, realistic CG humans. You need a sure. motion capture actor. You need somebody doing
At this point.
But, exactly.
Yeah.
But what I'm kind of thinking forward to is obviously, you know, where we're headed with AI and things, where we'll have, you know, you'll write a script and you'll just let it go and it'll generate the actor, it'll generate the scene and everything. And you'll right. say, oh, no, I want the wallpaper blue. And, you know, you'll type a few more things in and it'll do that. But, you know, it seems like the next thing beyond that is just to let the AI just write its own scripts, right. which I know there's already these funny examples, you know.
They're silly examples.
Yeah, silly examples. But then I really start thinking, well, what's the point? Like, whose story is it telling? You know right. what I mean? Like, when we read books and we watch movies now, it's a human story from a fellow human. You know, we're all around the campfire kind of sharing stories. But when we just sort of hand that all off to, and again, I'm not saying don't do it, you know, stop, you've got to stop AI now. I'm just thinking like, well, that's a really interesting thing. Like, what will it mean to us? Like, how will we connect to it when it's been completely generated by something that isn't even us? It's like, world. I don't know. It's weird. So, again, I'm still wrestling with all this stuff.
I mean, there could be a day where you look around and you say, you know, you get home, instead of watching Netflix, you say, all right, Netflix, make me a comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
Set a place here. And you like set up some loose plot points and then the movie starts.
Absolutely. Actually, in fact, I think that would be a great scene to see in a near future film.
Yeah.
Just as a throwaway, you know, but just where the person comes
just
home
to freak
and says, you know, I want a comedy, kind of a black comedy with, and I want, you know,
yeah,
I want Jim Carrey in it, but the weird Jim Carrey, not the really funny Jim Carrey, and whatever.
Yeah,
and then boom, this thing just starts playing.
Right. I mean, it could be.
It could be. It absolutely could be.
But I don't.
And sooner than we think.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the digital humans are going.
Yeah.
I think they have a more important role to play beyond the animation, the entertainment world.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And I think they have a lot of interesting things that they're going to provide for us.
Yeah.
So that they're going to play a role in our lives.
Yeah.
And that role could be an interface to a computer.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that are very lonely out there that could have virtual friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's, I think, a lot of things that could happen in that area that I think are important.
Well, and you know, there are, and like you said just then about people being lonely, and that, you know, Second Life really blew up for a while, and then it kind of faded again. But there was really something there about people wanting to be able to, you know, jump into this world. You know, it's been a promise for a long time of the,
sure.
of the sort of virtual, Ready Player One.
Okay. Yeah,
that world.
Yeah,
that's another you know, like games. That's another application where you need to have a computer generated person. It can't be a filmed person. It can't be an actor.
Yeah,
it's got to be something that's generated on the fly, that's responding to whatever. If it's an avatar for somebody, or if it's some kind of gameplay, or whatever it is, and that stuff, obviously, it's a no-brainer that we need. We need that stuff. We need it to get better and better. And, you know, you look at some of those demos recently from, you know, Unreal and others of, you know, real-time rendered humans. It's like, holy crap.
Yeah.
Look at that. You know, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So that stuff's, and that's, but, and, you know, I think there will be, as there always are, there's going to be some applications and things that I can't imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, 10 years from now, it'll be ubiquitous. You know, like Twitter, like before Twitter, I don't remember anybody going, you know what, in the future, somebody's going to make an app where everybody talks in little snippets and it's going to become huge. It's going to affect politics. It's going to be in everybody's life. It's going to
be like,
what are you talking about?
I mean, yeah,
what even is that?
It's like if you send a text message, but it goes to the whole world.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when it came out, I was like, what is that for? Is that just to let my, because it seemed like it was just designed to you know, your 10 friends know that you were heading out for a beer after work, and did they want to join you? Like, right. That seemed like that was what it was for.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, I don't need that. Whatever, okay.
I can just text them individually or call them.
Yeah, and then it became this whole other thing. It's crazy. And so anyways, I just think there are probably some things that CG Humans will be doing for us down the road that will be, I'll think back on right. it and think, oh man, I never saw that coming. That's crazy.
Right.
Or, you know, for good or bad, you know, we'll find out. Well, and then there's also the whole deepfakes thing. That's yeah. huge. That's already making its way right on into visual effects. And it's going to be super handy in the short term for things like digital doubles,
yep.
where we need to do a digital double, or we're just doing like a face swap on a stunt person to make them look like the actor. It's going to make that so much easier. And so I already know that there are right. visual effects companies out there that are using it and implementing it and yep. putting it into production. But that'll just continue to make more things possible that, you know.
And it'll be used for both good and evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always say that about visual effects generally, that yeah. they're like superpowers for the director. They can be used for good or evil. But right. in that case, for sure, because, you know, in the world of fake news, obviously,
yeah.
as that gets more and more perfect.
But I say the same thing about the internet. The internet is an amazing tool that we use every day, but it can be used for good or evil.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's really hard to put that. I want to touch on something else. You mentioned Ready Player One. Were you part of that?
Nope.
You were not part of that.
ILM.
Right.
Did a big chunk of it, not all of it, but I think was the lead vendor, but I didn't work on it. Yeah.
So there was a couple things, including Ready Player One, where the big thing when I started the WikiHuman project, right? Sorry, I'm stepping all over the place, but when I started WikiHuman project, people in my company were worried. It's like, are we gonna get into that weird zone with humans? And he's like, oh, you're talking about the Uncanny Valley.
Right.
I said, well, the whole point is for us to figure that out.
Right. Yeah.
And they're like, okay. And so I'm very interested in the Uncanny Valley. And I think while a lot of people who are on the WikiHuman project are trying very, very hard not to be in the Uncanny Valley,
right.
I'm actually interested in why the Uncanny Valley exists, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And there's some strangeness about it that makes it interesting to me.
Yeah.
Ready Player One, these are supposed to be fictional CG characters.
Yep.
And they're not necessarily in the Uncanny Valley. In fact, it was really clever about how they avoided it.
They're slightly anime-ish,
yeah.
kind of game-ish, kind of,
and,
yeah.
And that made it, it was, because ILM is obviously very skilled at this kind of stuff, they have a really interesting way to avoid it. But it still brought up the question of the Uncanny Valley
yeah.
in some ways,
yeah.
you know? And then, what's the other one I'm thinking of? And I'm blanking on it. Battle Angel?
Oh, yeah. Alita, Battle Angel, yeah.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people were basically saying, this is terrible, she's in the Uncanny Valley. And this is comments on the internet, right?
Right, right,
and people
yeah,
are saying,
yeah.
like, if they really want to do this right, they should get Weta to do it. And like, Weta is doing it.
Yeah.
James Cameron is involved in
yeah.
this as an executive producer. These are talented people.
Yeah.
My feeling about her is that she doesn't fit in this world, and people are uncomfortable around her.
Yeah.
So the Uncanny Valley feels like a plot point.
Yeah. I'm actually excited about it.
Yeah.
I saw it, I thought, well, that's cool. In fact, the thing is, I actually don't enjoy making totally just normal CG humans that much. It's a yeah. lot of work. It's hard, especially ones that are supposed to resemble somebody specific, you know,
right,
like an
yeah.
actor. I just find it's challenging, and it's, you know, it's good to have challenges, but I creatively, it's not that interesting to me.
Okay.
But something like her, I think would be super fun to do.
Right.
Or like on Rango, we had this one scene where he meets with this character called the Spirit of the West, but it was a stylized kind of Clint Eastwood from the Sergio Leone films.
Mm-hmm.
And the stylization we did on him, you know, texturally and everything, it's very, what's the word? Not realistic, but kind of photographic. Like it's
right.
it's sort of like a realistic CG human, but then with like pushed proportions and pushed textures and things. And that to me is way more fun and interesting. Like I would love to do some more stuff in films where it's very realistic, but it isn't a normal human. It's a some other thing, like a Battle Angel. I think that, that would be a cool, really cool challenge. I'd love to work on something like that. So anyways, that's where I fall on that.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think you're right about it. And I'm very interested to find out, like, you know, how things like that happen and what's going to happen with digital human. And in fact, isn't the name of your talk Human-ish?
Well, I called it Human-ish because I didn't want to stick strictly to talking about CG humans. So I kind of talk a little bit about doing Davy Jones and some other characters that were on, at least on my personal path toward doing them and things I learned on them.
Right.
So, and the orcs and Warcraft and all that. So that's why I called it Human-ish, because it's sort of CG humans and human-like characters. But yeah, so.
Well, that's great. I think it's really cool. And so I think it'll be interesting to see that. And I'm definitely looking forward to your talk. And then you're going to be on my panel tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that will be fun.
I heard there's wine with that. Is that right?
Well, if it starts at 11:30, there better be wine.
Yeah. So. And there's also Paul DeBevick's talk.
That's coming up in about an hour, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really want to hear that. And in fact, I'm guessing that I will listen to his talk and then go back and make adjustments to my talk. it'll spur new thoughts. I'm like, that's a good thing, and that'll help add a slide.
So it's interesting you say you're not really interested in digital humans, but you put yourself into that world a little bit.
I mean, I love doing, you know, Rogue One was just an awesome project for a thousand different reasons. And I enjoy is not the right word because it was really, really hard, but I valued doing the Tarkin and Leia digital characters a lot. A, because I learned a ton, we all did. Mm-hmm. And B, because I love that world, I love Star Wars, and I love those characters. But just saying, if tomorrow one of the producers at ILM came to me and said, okay, we've got this project and we're doing a young John Wayne, and he's in, 700 shots in the film. He's got to look just like John Wayne.
Right.
I'd be like, no, please, don't give me that project. I don't want to do that. Because it's just, you know what it's going to be. It's going to be day after day after day of dailies of just staring at that actor's face going, well, why? Ah, he looked good in the last scene. Why doesn't he look good in this scene? There's something off. Like, what is it? And I'd much rather...
But isn't that always the problem with the Uncanny Valley? You notice something's wrong, but you don't know what it is.
That's one of the problems.
Yeah.
One of the problems is sensing something's wrong, but not being able to suss out. Because at a certain level, and that's the whole thing with the Uncanny Valley, is that it's that last 2%, right? So it's not the bold, obvious stuff anymore. It's the really subtle, weird stuff that's in there. So that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is what I call the sort of swamp of opinions, which is you can have a room full of really bright, incredibly talented people, and they're staring at the CG character, and you know there are times when there's a consensus. Everyone goes, okay, yeah, the spec is off, or the subsurface scattering, or the whatever, and everyone walks out of the room with their marching orders, and we're all aligned.
Right.
But a lot of the time you're in there and you know, everybody wants to be the sleuth who's got the solution, right?
Right.
And they'll go, you know, one person will
fingers
say,
fingers in the pie.
They'll say, you know what it is? Here's what it is. Her forehead's too high. The hairline's too far back, or her forehead's too high. Something. And then somebody else will go, no, that's her hair. Look at this reference. It's like, the forehead's fine. I'll tell you what it is. Her chin's too pointy.
Right.
Look at her chin. Look how pointy her chin is. And I swear, like, it'll just go on and on like that.
Yeah.
And it's difficult because there's no consensus, but it's also tough because your own instinct, you'll start to question your own instincts. Like you walk in the room and you'll think you know, they'll play it once and you go, okay, I think I know what's bumping here. But then everybody starts talking and you start watching it and they keep looping it. And then pretty soon you're like, well, I don't know, maybe that's not, I don't, you know. And that to me is the most difficult thing about it.
Yeah.
It's all the opinions. And losing your compass, like losing track of even what your own opinion is.
I also think that when it doesn't look right, obviously it falls in Uncanny Valley. So you usually have a very negative emotional response to it, right?
Yeah.
And then when that happens and you start to make a correction, it doesn't matter what correction you make, way overcorrect.
Yeah.
And therefore you're just bouncing around all over the place. You never get to the medium that you need to be.
Yeah. That's
true. It's tough.
And all the steps are hard. I mean, you know, particularly when you're doing a CG human that is a recognizable person, you know, getting the model right is really hard. Getting the textures right is really hard. Getting the hair groom right is really hard. You know, the look dev, really hard. But even once you get there, where you've got this static model, you're looking at the turntable, and everybody's like, man, that's great. That is, you nailed it. Mm-hmm. Then you start moving it, and you're just in a whole new world of pain. Like every single little thing, every, you know, polygon you move on that face is it's just so easy to break. It's like instantly easy to break. And particularly with something like, for instance, use Tarkin as an example again, you know, we captured Guy Henry performance. Guy's a terrific actor. He did a great job, but he doesn't use his face like Peter Cushing did. Of course, nobody, two people do, right? Maybe twin, identical twins or something, but he doesn't smile like Peter Cushing. And we didn't ask him to do like physical mimicry of Tarkin. That would have been really difficult. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, I think if you're doing Elvis or something, you know, you can probably go out there and find some people who do pretty darn good Elvis expressions and things. Sure. And so that would help you. But Peter Cushing, I don't think there's too many Peter Cushing impersonators out there in the world.
No.
And so finding somebody who could do that and who's a great actor and everything is kind of an impossible task. So we looked for somebody who was a great actor, who had the right bearing and presence and tonality in their voice and could do that kind of accent without, again, trying to necessarily be an impersonator of Peter Cushing. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so the problem is, you know, he's not using his face the way Peter Cushing did. So you have to modify it. If you modify it too much, it feels modified. It feels weird. It starts to feel Frankenstein or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you're fighting against the, you've got two goals, right? One is how real does it look just as a human being on screen? And the other thing is likeness, right? How much does it look like this specific person you're trying to make? And sometimes those two things would fight each other. Because if you just took the capture straight out, just the deltas straight off of Guy and slapped it right on our Tarkin model, it looked good. It looked real.
Right.
Like it looked like a real person talking.
Yeah.
Very natural. It just didn't look like Tarkin anymore. It just took him off model. So then if you nudge things around, if the animators nudge things around to make him smile more like Tarkin and use his phonemes like Tarkin, if you took too heavy a hand with that, it started to look more like Cushing if you stopped on any one frame. But in motion, it started to feel weird.
Yeah.
So that's a whole nightmare.
Yeah, it is.
But the thing that I think will help us with that going forward is to have more correct and real underlying muscle systems.
So you think muscle deformations are going to be a big deal?
It'll help us in cases like that where we have to make changes to it.
Right.
Because, you know, when you're just doing it with blend shapes and you're sort of working from the outward in, you're just affecting the shell that is the CG face. It's really easy to do things that aren't really the way a face works. You know, don't behave the way a face actually works. And that's, I think, for me, a big part of where it starts to break in a lot of cases, where it looks right, but then when it's moving, there's some weird thing as it gets from the F shape to the O shape to the you know, there's some weird little in-between moments that just don't feel physically right.
Right.
And I think if we had a legal, you know, enforcement of anatomically correct motion on the face, so that when we made those tweaks, and we're working on it. We have a system we're working on. I've seen some really encouraging tests. So the next time around, if I had to do Tarkin again tomorrow, I would do that.
Interesting.
So we could still tweak on top of the capture, but the tweaks that we make would always be always remain legal in terms of how a face should work.
Yeah.
You know, and that'll help us a lot.
Well, that's interesting.
At least on the motion
side. Yeah, it's fascinating. We're just pretty close to an hour, which has been awesome.
Cool.
I want to know basically, what do you think of the event so far? Even though we've been here once on Sunday.
Yeah, I got here Sunday night. It's fantastic.
Yeah,
Malta is amazing. Valletta is beautiful, and the event itself is really good.
Like,
it's a great lineup. Andre is just a dynamo. The guy that that founded it and is running it, and it's awesome.
That's
cool. Really good.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you were able to come, and I was so excited when I saw your name on the thing. It's like, I've been wanting to talk to Hal for so long. So it's been really cool. And sorry, it's been really hard to schedule things, so I know we've been back and forth for a while.
Nah,
but at least we got to do it now.
Yeah,
so. All right. Well, thanks so much, Hal. I appreciate it.